And we are back with another edition of the Daily Dots. And I am joined, as always, by the brain trust himself, Mr. Chase Taylor. Not a whole lot out today, Chase. Indexes kind of just did a reversal today of what they did all last week, which probably, you know, which really wasn't much of a surprise. You were down pretty, it was a pretty red week.
Very.
I mean, especially the things that went down, right? Some of the darlings, including that 10% sell-off on NVIDIA in a single day on no news. And that trend continues. And I don't really know what it means. I feel like we've been commenting on this for a while. Just unheard of volatility when you consider the size of the companies, and you've seen it. I mean, obviously, I feel like NVIDIA is probably easier to understand just because of, you know, the move up it's had.
Its volatility is just high, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess it's probably – it's pretty understandable. It just amazes me, though, the moves you've seen and even some of the darling stocks, as big as they are. You know, you're not used to watching companies, you know, the top 10 largest companies in the S&P – you know, swing in 50% ranges in the course of, you know, 12 months, in some cases even shorter than that. So anyway, I don't know what to make of it other than just, you know, it's it's not just penny stocks and OTC type stuff that you need to be worried about when it comes to these big moves. But largely speaking, NASDAQ, we finished up around right around 1% on the day, 1.1, where are we at?
Yeah, so for the Qs, 1.01. S&P was up 0.87. Small caps up 1.1. Mag 7 was 0.93. Spot VIX down almost 10%. Yields were pretty flat across the board. It was kind of a nothing burger. Oil was flat. Maybe the big one of the day was how not flat precious metals were, with gold down almost 3% on the day. But even with the big day up, like, you still had some unimpressive price action in some pockets.
Kind of a
Tesla down another over 3% again. So
outside of Tesla and a couple others, kind of a sell volatility type day across the board.
I think you had a lot of people buying, having to go out and buy vol just based on their fear of the geopolitical situation, and they probably unwound it today, like, well, all clear and just let it go.
Yeah, but even
now they
stocks,
can go back to single stock or single day volatility instead of having to like reach out a week or a month in the future on vol.
Yeah. I don't, this market is, I for me anyway, it's getting increasingly hard to understand the moves. So like we've talked about, the it's not getting any less complicated. That's for sure.
Never will ever again, I don't think.
Yeah. I think there are times where, you know, I don't know. I kind of long for the clarity you had like at the end of 2021, like when, you know, it doesn't mean we couldn't have been wrong, but just being long energy and short tech in that environment, just, you know, in short bonds, it just felt like a really fat pitch.
Yeah.
You know?
And it worked for a year, whereas we talked about this morning, like, yeah, last week you kind of had a good setup where you kind of knew liquidity was going to come out, and then you hit a point where you realize, like, oh, CTAs have to sell. So you're like, oh, well, that's a two-headed snake that's probably going to bite the market pretty hard. And so it was kind of easier to like lean against it. And then you come in this week and you're like, well, now who knows? Like, you might have the systematic folks be able to chill out and stop selling. You might have, you know, liquidity start coming back in. So like, it just, you look at the chart, everything went straight down, so it could rally 5-8% without even doing that much on a lot of these single names. So like, this is makes for a very tough environment, a lot less signal in the noise, I would say.
It does too. You know, one of the things that I look for too, these have been horrible ways. Well, not, I wouldn't say horrible, but very bad timing mechanisms. It really hasn't helped you much on the time. But it does intrigue me, the story behind gold. You know, now that gold had a nice pullback, kind of its first one of this recent run, you know, the stories by and large, you hear it all over Twitter, you see it all over CNBC in the headlines. Oh, gold pulling back is eases over Iran and Israel abate or, you know, pull back, blah, blah. And I'm sitting there going, nah, I don't really think, I mean, maybe that added some premium into that move. I don't think that move was about that. Again, do geopolitical tensions help out oil? Sure. And gold, excuse me. Yeah, of course. Right? That's part of it. But I don't think the move from gold's breakout of 2050 to where it is today was sold on the back of Iran and Israel.
Not at all.
No, I think it has a lot.
You could say like the last 5-10% maybe was pushed along, but you've had like a nice 30% move. Like,
yeah, I think it's all about, you know, at the end of the day, and I think, and I, you'd have to go back and look at the dates and see how it lines up, but I think all of it has to do, a lot of it, with kind of the Fed reversing track and or reversing their path and, you know, sounding like, at least for an extended period of time, that they wanted to hike into a strong economy. And I think that's what it's all about. And the interesting thing here is I think the market seems to think that that's over. I don't know what you think, and I don't want to get too off course. It is the dots. It's not a long form interview, but I can't help but to think, just to me, it feels and looks a lot like investors are really offside on that one, or that the market is really offside on that one. Meaning, I think the story in golds and the metals by and large is a much larger story that's going to last for a long time. And it's going to be volatile. And whenever you have days like today, you're going to get all the people coming out, oh, we told you to short gold, it's a pet rock, blah, 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 blah. Right. It's just part of riding a commodity boom. But I don't know. Do you share that sentiment? Meaning, look, it's one of the reasons we use stop loss and manage risk, because, you know, come Wednesday, I could feel completely different and we could be out of the majority of our gold holdings, you know, listening to what the market has to say about it. But what I was going to say was this. I have had tremendous amounts of success fading something that the overall market, whether I was long something that went up when this, or whether I was fading something the market was long, I've had huge success fading something that everybody in the market knew to be true that just wasn't.
Right. That's where all the alpha is. Yeah.
Right. And then, but waiting until that moment of realization comes, as opposed to, you know, I've also realized that you can be 100% right and get your face ground in the dirt while you're waiting for that realization to come. And especially with something like gold, because it's not intrinsically tied to anything. And I've tried to explain this to our clients by saying, look, if global economic activity picks up, by and large, you can expect a greater bid for oil, right? If construction picks up, you can expect a greater bid for copper, right? Gold doesn't really have one of those. You know what I mean? There is no one-off scenario where somebody could say, hey, give me a scenario in which you can guarantee me we'll push gold higher. And I'm like, I can't give you one of those, right? It's kind of a, there's a sentiment aspect to it, you know, which the detractors use against it. I understand their logic, but I tend to disagree with them. I think, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 years of recorded human history say a lot. But what are your thoughts? What are you seeing in the markets? We talked about rates. I think it is interesting to me that the long end was up, not a lot today, yeah, mildly.
Like one at the end, by the end of the day.
Okay, not a big deal. But it also appears to me interest rates are meaning less and less on a daily basis in these moves. And I think it's true to both sides. I'm not sitting there, yeah, saying it's one or the other. It just, you know, it used to be, and for good,
I think it's because they matter less to the real economy. Like, not much point in mattering to markets if they don't matter as much to the real economy. That's not to say they never will. It's just what asset prices do and the trillions of dollars of wealth they create when they go up. Like, who cares if your interest rate went up a little bit? Like, if your revenue's up, you know, 12% and your interest rate's up 1%, like, whatever.
Yeah.
I just think you just see that bleeding through. Like, you get to the point, especially for all the people tied to floating rate where and have very small margins, like, yeah, some of those are going to get squeezed out. But does Google care what the interest rate is? Absolutely not.
No.
None of the big players in the market cap dominated stock market you know, are really impacted in any meaningful way by rates. So until the rates can in some way pinch consumers, like, it just doesn't matter. And even that, it's not easy for rates to pinch consumers when all of the, you know, the big time consumers are all the boomers that also are getting 5% interest income for owning T-bills. So
there's lots of ways for them to offset it.
I think that's one of those things that a lot of people are still missing is when you have debt at levels that we have, incredibly high levels of debt, right? Whenever they're this high and you have rates go this high, that is a lot of private sector income. And when you have a lot of private sector income, it is really difficult to have the economy kind of melt down. So I think, you know, if rates stay higher for longer, that's just, and if deficits blow out that much more, or even just stay around 5 to 7, 8% of GDP, like, that's a lot of private sector income, and it all going to the class of people that also own a bunch of stocks.
Yeah, no, I think that there are a lot of obviously wonky things about where we're currently at that make this a very tough comp historically.
Yeah, a lot of things have turned upside down from what the last 40 years taught everybody.
Yeah, but I think that, like you said, I think that there's, I don't think, I think there's going to be a big mistake, and I see it being made every day, and it seems to be being made more by the younger people in our industry, which is, okay, now those things don't matter. And I sit there and I'm like, well, hold on a second. I think that you have a very unique board in front of you. Like you and I talked about, this economic setup really is not comparable to any we've seen in the past. Certainly not in any market practitioner's lifetime that are currently in the game, right? You know, whether we talk about the debt loads, you know, debt loads that have previously been, you know, not seen in the history of the United States, deficits that have only been seen one time before in a completely different backdrop, right? Like, I mean, you were on the gold standard at that time. You know, just a very tough comp. And I'm not even saying that a tough comp, meaning we should take this conclusion or that conclusion from it. Just looking at all the, you know, looking at the record amount of wealth concentration in one demographic group being the baby boomers, right? There's just so many things. And I think all too often, quote unquote, economic rules are sort of generalities, right? That if we look at things in a normal setting, this is what normally occurs. But when 10% of a country's population owns over 50% of the wealth and assets, when a government is running 7% or close to 6.5-7% deficits in peacetime, and that same government's running 150% debt to GDP, and you've got the central bank with almost one third of GDP on their balance sheet, you know, you use so many of these anomalies. I don't want to belabor the point, but I think one of the big mistakes would be to sit there, you know, to say, okay, you know, this backdrop is completely different. We've never seen anything like it. The old rules don't apply. Like you said, I don't know if it's the old rules don't apply or just the shuffling of the deck. You know, for instance, can higher interest rates be somewhat stimulative? It appears as though that is possible. And on the face of it, it makes some decent sense. When 50% of all assets are owned by 10% of the people, right? I mean, and those people by and large are retired or close to it. And those higher interest rates also have equated to higher Social Security payouts, higher stock accounts, higher yield from their bond portfolio, can make some sense.
Not exactly hurting them.
No, no. The only issue you've got though is it really puts a strain on future economic growth. Don't you think? I mean, meaning, you know, the baby boomers are not going to keep consuming the way they are, right? And if anything, their consumption slows down as they age.
True. Yeah.
Right. Well, it's going to be really tough to see the same type of economic productivity It's going to be really tough to see historically normal levels of consumption coming out of the younger generations with prices where they're at. I mean, unless wages keep ripping at this pace, which is going to undoubtedly put pressure on the companies at some point.
Right. I think it depends on the way assets are transferred between generations, like what that looks like. And that, I mean, remains to be seen. But, you know, if you think of your average millennial getting the average net worth from the average boomer in the next decade, like that makes some people go from struggling to balling real quick. And you could argue like household formation and consumption kind of jumps whenever they get their hands on the wealth that maybe their boomer parents are just kind of sitting on. That's, you know, especially for the boomers that aren't out there yellow and their money and traveling, because that's happening a bunch.
Hey, this, I think this begs a different question. It's certainly not what I'm, not what I'm thinking of, but I've heard some people that are not, I mean, I wouldn't call them highly credible, but I wouldn't call them idiots either, making for an argument that there is no such thing as a business cycle anymore. And, you know, naturally when I hear something like that, my, you know, my knee-jerk reaction is, that's what they always say. I think it's an interesting question though. Meaning when you look at, when you, like, for instance, when you look at, you know, happenings of the last 4 years, and you look where security prices still are, and you look at the state of the economy, you know, you and I have talked about this before. It's pretty hard to argue, you know, barring some type of, again, exogenous threat, which is an ever-present threat that hangs over everything all the time, right? It's like the old adage, you know, well, what could go wrong? And you're like, well, a comet could hit the earth. Well, right. That's all, that's an ever-present threat, right? It's really hard to look at this political setup and the economic setup and all of it and envision a scenario which, in, you know, that stocks are going to go down massively at some point over the next 2 years.
Yeah, but I think business cycles and stocks going down massively are two different things. But what I will say on that, and I don't think business cycles have by any means gone away, because at the end of the day, a business cycle is just, it's just, you know, human nature.
Right.
But if you think about it, like, we graduated high school almost 25 years ago. And from that recession that happened, like, right about the time that we graduated high school, right, like 2000, since then, there's been, you know, one, like, real legit recession. And that wasn't caused by the business cycle. It was,
right.
I mean, that was a financial crisis
yeah.
caused that, you know, asset price problem.
Yeah.
So even that wasn't like a normal business cycle where you're like, oh, well, we got the inventories wrong. And like, now we got to let some people go. Like, it wasn't a normal cycle at all. So we haven't had like a garden variety business cycle recession. And you could probably argue that 2001 wasn't either. So like, I don't know, since the maybe the mid 90s or something, like, so that the argument, like, we don't really have that anymore, is fair. Like, we've talked a lot about how, like, we just had a manufacturing recession. No, didn't really hurt anything. Because manufacturing is such a small part of the economy now. Everything's so services driven that,
see, I kind of
have like a real services recession. And what does that even look like?
See, I kind of have a little bit of a different outlook on the late 90s, early 2000s, just because I know what you're saying. It's not typical, meaning you didn't see the big jump in unemployment. You didn't see the stock market got rocked, but that was just because it was so ridiculously high.
I would argue like that's what caused it.
Yeah, not, right.
Like, it wasn't like a typical business, you know.
No, but it was triggered by something pretty typical. I mean, the Fed started raising rates in the beginning of 2000. You know what I mean? So like I see what you're saying, but it had semblances of kind of more of a normal situation. Whereas, like, you know, I'm with you 100%. I mean, 07, 08, there was nothing in quote unquote, if this is even a term, business cyclicality that spurred that on. I mean, that was just a classic asset bubble, hyperbolic, you know, run up, run down, and blow up everything,
in
the path. Yeah. So 20, I mean, you could make the argument, and even then, like 99 and 2000 was more, you know, there were more intricacies. What is that? The other thing I think is interesting about 99 and 2000. So if that was the last time where we had, you know, we'll call it a quasi recession, you know, that was the last year, I believe in 2000, was it 99 or 2000? That was the last year where you actually had a net reduction in government spending.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you. It's got to be something like that.
Something like that, because they balanced the budget there in the late 90s, and then boom, you had a recession. I'm just wondering how much government spending is really moving the needle. And well, I mean, right now it appears to be the only game in town.
Yeah, I think it's moving it definitely significantly.
Yeah.
It's the prime mover of everything.
Yeah. And you're looking at a scenario where I don't really think they can back off anytime soon.
We just did what, another $100 billion worth of you know, foreign military aid stuff. So like, just here you go, $100 billies. Like, so the idea that they back away from that, I mean, eventually they will, but it becomes when the median voter is, Marco Papich likes to point out, like when the median voter feels the pain and decides that austerity is their answer, that's when Congress will do it. But until then, at the moment, clearly everyone thinks like more of all this stuff is good, right? Whether it's industrial policy, because that's a way to fight against China and get jobs and stuff, or, you know, more goodies for everyone over 50, like 55, whatever, like none of that's going away. Like if you ran on, I'm getting rid of Social Security right now, like you'd get like no percent.
Did you see that? You may not follow him. There's a young, not young, he's about my age, but you know, fairly young for a surgeon. There's a young surgeon in my, he's interested in finance. So he's on FinTwit in my feed. And, he just bought a beautiful car, like an i7 BMW decked out, like the electric version, you know, $110,000 car or something like that. And he posted on Twitter the other day that he went to go make a payment on his student loans and they were gone. They were paid off. He got it. They're like, now I am not saying, like, I am not saying anything about anybody that's gotten them paid off. Like, I have still one small student loan that of my wife's that I have not paid off for that same reason. Like, I'm just like, hey, it just seems silly to me to pay it off until the election, you know, whatever, right? Just until you're convinced that somebody isn't going to pay it off. But man, they're paying off surgeons' student loans. I mean, he's got to be making a quarter of a million a year if he's making 100, right? I mean, he's a surgeon.
Yeah.
It just gets more and more egregious every single day. And I don't know, man. I don't want to be the sky is falling, Chicken Little, or anything like that, because I mean, we're unquestionably on an unsustainable path. Just how far does it go? And from right here, from right now, I think you look out of the road and you're like, I feel like it'd go on for quite a while. It's what it feels like. It's what it looks like.
Yeah. I mean, I think whenever you just look out at all the levers that can still be pulled, that's when you realize like, this isn't, we're not at the end. Like,
no,
there's still ways to shove. Yeah. All I gotta do is just yield curve control, cap the yields, shove it down some different balance sheets throat. There's so much runway for all that.
Yeah. And I think one of the biggest kickers to it is pretty simple. It's that it's either that or the flip side of that is the reality is just isn't palatable to anybody. Like, right. Not on a political basis.
Until inflation is really high and people recognize that it's really high because the deficit is really high, none of this matters.
Listen to what just came out of your mouth. Once people realize that that inflation stuff is too high and that the deficit being too high has an interplay in that, when you just think about the amount.
You can't even get finance people to agree on that, much less the public.
Yeah. And I don't.
So until then.
It's amazing to me. Yeah. And it's amazing to me how in the information age where there's so much information knowledge floating around, so many people believe in the most ridiculous. Like, am I saying it's one? No, there's never. You and I have talked about this a million times. Anytime somebody's selling you a silver bullet economic story on anything, there is no one factor, right? And I'm not saying it's just one factor. But to deny that you're running the biggest deficits since World War II and you're also experienced the biggest shock of inflation in the last 40 years and that those two things don't have a correlation, I mean, come on. I don't even know. Hey, by the way, did you get a chance to listen to that interview with Michael Howell and the other guy that we were talking about?
I've listened to like half of it now, yeah.
What did you come away thinking from that? And for but for those of you guys who want to know, there's a podcast. It was on
Ford Guidance. Yeah,
Jack Farley's podcast, Ford Guidance.
A liquidity debate.
And for the nerdier of you out there, the real wonks, Michael Howell, he's a guy that we follow his work closely because he's kind of led the charge on this whole liquidity thing. And I think he's had a pretty remarkable track record and a lot of proof backing up his work.
100%.
And he went in, I don't know, what's the name of the guys that he – was it George something?
Yeah, Robertson, I believe.
Yeah, George Robertson. Quirky dude. It's hard to follow some of his arguments.
Yep.
What did you come away with from that?
So what I like about him is that he like just kind of boils it all down to just all that matters is the deficit. Like forget all this other stuff. If the deficit is high, asset prices are going to go up. I should say stock prices are going to go up. Where you know, Michael Howell like really drills in on liquidity and all the different functions of liquidity. I think the trap a lot of people get into with liquidity is they just look at Fed liquidity or they just look at central bank liquidity. And then Michael Howell is like, yeah, that's great. But like private sector is even bigger. And then if you add in cross-border capital flows, like you're just missing these huge like gears in the liquidity machine. So he looks at all of it, basically all the money that is out there that could find itself into assets is kind of more or less what he's tracking. And when that moves up, asset prices go up. He's shown the correlation. It's a very good correlation. So if you know where the liquidity puck is going, you can largely get that right.
And to back that up, that was one of the reasons that we were very defensively positioned, and you even got us more defensively positioned right by the end of last week, which was we had tax day. We figured that would create a serious pullback in liquidity. Sure enough, that pullback in liquidity happened,
right?
And stock market corrected 6% in a week.
Yeah, so I think the deficit didn't go down, right?
No.
Now it's a very tactical thing. It's just a week, but it's one that like it's something that Michael Howell like highlighted. Hey, like April could have, you know, you could have a little some issues, some hiccups in April because liquidity might become an issue. You know, the deficit didn't get any better, so at least for April, like the way he would argue it, to me, it makes way more sense than the Robertson argument. Now, if you're like, yeah, I don't care about a month, like I'm just zoomed out here, then fine. Like you can just go, yeah, the deficit's really big, everything's going up. And so I think both guys might be right in that way. I just maybe because I'm so much more of I like to have a tactical overlay on long-term investing, like because of that, like I tend to appreciate Michael Howell's approach. And hey, the deficit was big before October of 2022. And if you were long all of 2022 with the big deficit, you're getting your face ripped off.
Yeah.
So Howell called the bottom because of liquidity. Whereas if you were just going like, oh, deficit's big, like I'm going to buy, like it didn't work. Right.
Yeah.
So I think if you want to do some sort of getting the timing at least partially right, you have to look at it the way Michael Howell does. So.
Well, and look,
I'm more in his camp.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And for those of you out there going, well, that's because you didn't look at this. You didn't look at like, look, I wish, and I've said this many times before, I wish we didn't have to look at these things. I wish it was simple as buying good companies at reasonable prices, right? GARP, growth at a reasonable price. I wish it was as simple as that. The problem is in this environment with the issues that you currently have and then looking at valuations, you know, it's just hard being managing somebody else's money in this environment. You know, a lot of the things that are making the portfolio work are not at safe valuation. I mean, it's just hard to find a lot of things that are at safe valuation levels. And when you find things that make sense, you know, I always think to myself, look, if things go wrong here and you end up with bad outcomes, can you at least say that you did your job, right?
Right.
And the toughest thing that I feel like we face on a daily basis that prevents us from being just more buy and hold things is that when you look at a lot of the things that are working, that are generating returns, I think you have to accept one of two realities. A, I think you have to accept significant periods of significant underperformance with probably short periods of massive catching up.
Right.
Almost like a watered down version of Spitznagel's portfolio. Right. Right. And I think you can outperform doing that if you've got an iron constitution. Or I think you have to sort of ride with what's working today and really keep a close eye on risk and exposure and, you know, getting defensive when you see pullbacks and liquidity. I don't really see there being any other way. People might ask me, well, Zach, why aren't you doing that whole buy and hold thing? Look, investors need to be realistic with themselves. If you can sit on a portfolio and watch it go nowhere for 5 years, then maybe that's the best way to go. Problem is, not many businesses and not many investors can stomach that kind of thing.
It's great for family office, just not really great for anyone that faces.
Well, let's be real about it. One of the reasons that you've seen so many of these legendary hedge fund managers shut things down and go to a family office is for the reasons that we're talking about right now, right? Where they're sitting there saying, hey, I feel comfortable taking big swings in this environment with my money. I just don't want to do with anybody else's.
Right. And if you want to invest in things that are going to pay you through buybacks, that's going to take time and it's not going to be that pretty.
Yeah.
If you try to start a big hedge fund to say like, we're just going to buy like, cigarette companies 30 years ago, like no one would have given you money.
Yeah.
Now you would have absolutely destroyed and outperformed everybody, but on a year-to-year basis, it doesn't always look or feel that good.
Yeah. Yeah. Just,
you look back 30 years later and you're like, oh wow, that made a lot of money.
I've had that conversation with clients so many times. They're like, why didn't we do this? And I'm like, cause see this point in the chart right here?
That's where you would have called
me. You would have fired me. You would have fired me. You can't, you start freaking out when we're down, you know, if the market's down 35% and we're down 9%.
And it's the same, even when you talk about like NVIDIA, Amazon, you know, the companies everyone wish they would have bought. And both of those companies have had, I think 5+80% drawdowns, all of which would have gotten people that own them fired.
Yeah.
If you own them, you know, more than 2% of your portfolio or something.
Yeah. Yep. It makes it a difficult deal. What do we have coming up? I mean, we got big earnings coming out this week with
It is the week for earnings. It's the most companies reporting this week. It's a lot of most of the big tech earnings will be this week. And then on the data side, tomorrow we have Philly Fed Services, S&P PMIs, both services and manufacturing, new home sales, Richmond manufacturing. Not much Wednesday. Thursday we have KC Fed manufacturing and the Q1 GDP print, which is going to be, I think, higher than the current estimates. Friday we'll have the PCE, so we'll get the inflation that the Fed watches most carefully, which it's not going to be crazy, but it should still be pretty firm at like 0.3. We'll also get personal income and spending, University of Michigan's consumer sentiment survey, Kansas City's services PMI. So pretty big week.
Yeah, pretty weighty week.
Yeah, nothing. None of the monster, you know, inflation or jobs prints like those weeks. But considering earnings, it's a big one. The one thing I want to say right before we go is you mentioned like not being able to like get things at safe valuations like levels. That I think one of the things you can do now is to try to buy things at safe technical levels, and
yeah,
kind of lets you, you know, massage positioning on, well, like, I really like this thing, but it, you know, hey, maybe it's priced a little sporty, but if it goes below here, then, you know, you get out. And if it goes above here, then you press it. Like, it's just like a different way to do a similar thing. There's always safe levels, just different ways of making safety.
Yeah, I know. And especially with something like gold. I mean, if people have been listening to this, you know, the dots, I think they know where we stand on that. Having said that, we had a pretty lengthy conversation this morning about just making sure that we've got our game plan. And look, when you're running, like with gold especially, you know, if you're trying to trade it or whatever, be invested in gold, yeah. I mean, don't listen to us at your own peril. I will just tell you though that no matter how bullish you feel on gold or pretty much any other commodity for that matter. You got to have your levels just because you're not going to get fundamental. Like you said, you know, if your fundamental reason for buying gold is the government spending too much money,
it's always true.
Yeah, it's always true. And you need to be prepared to be wrong for a very long time. It just is what it is.
Like I told you this morning, hey, if the Chinese central bank decides that they want to take a couple months off from buying gold in size, like,
it'll go down.
It's going to get whacked.
Yep. It'll go down. And I think one of the primary reasons that we were discussing this morning, which I don't see it being in play, is even with that recent run-up in gold, you saw virtually no uptake from U.S. investors.
Yeah.
They're still looking to buy the dip in tech stocks and pick up Bitcoin. They're not, no one's interested in gold.
If they don't step in and China steps back, like it just, or Asia in general, buyers step back, then it's going to have a big pullback.
Yeah. And I honestly think that, I think that gold is going to have a real headwind going up against Bitcoin too. I mean, I think that's one of the things that Bitcoin's going to steal money from it.
Yeah. I think it has already and will continue to.
Yep.
For sure.
Yep.
That was one of the alarming, or not alarming, like one of the notable things from the last, call it month, is Bitcoin kind of went down and gold's just kept going up.
It
was an interesting little month of relative performance there.
But like you said, we got
the way today.
Got to be careful. That could have just been the Chinese in there buying, right? So, all right, man. That about, you didn't have any quotes from that book you wanted to read us, did you?
No.
Okay. All right. Anyway, just got to make sure he doesn't have something up his sleeve, guys. Anyway, we will be back again tomorrow, as always. Just going to keep chronicling this whole fascinating period of time. We'll go through a breakdown of some of the earnings reports that came out, as well as any other pertinent economic information. Until then, we'll see you tomorrow. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.